Sponsorship of this KQED podcast is provided by San Francisco State University's graduate business programs offering 5 accredited advanced degrees, the SF State MBA, rigorous, real-world, respected, open house schedule, and more information at mba.sfsu.edu.
Funds for the California Report are provided by Chevron, investing in renewables, strengthening communities, and creating jobs. More information available at chevron.com. The California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org. And URS Corporation, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical services to public agencies and private companies. URSCorp.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up in Sacramento, it's out with the old, in with the old. Same old budget cuts, anyway. So how is Jerry Brown going to sell it?
We've cut the structural deficit substantially, and we now have the possibility of eliminating, over the next several years, the deficits that have plagued California.
Also, what sleep researchers are learning about dreams, nightmares, and post-traumatic stress disorder. And it turns out the holidays are tough on the baby Jesus. We'll meet a woman who saw a business opportunity.
They come for different reasons. Maybe they're missing a finger or the arm fell off or something. Everybody bring them around to fix them.
And we'll talk with the winner of our Only in California photo contest. It's the California Report. Well, 2012 isn't even a week old yet, and already it's looking a lot like 2011 in Sacramento, at least in this respect. Governor Brown's new state budget calls for more painful cuts. Once again, health and welfare programs for women and kids are on the chopping block, along with potentially a whole lot more. But it's not all bad news, and there are a few caveats. Joining us to help sort it out, our Sacramento Bureau Chief, John Myers. Hi, John.
Hello, Scott.
Well, first of all, John, if you would, give us a little bit of context for this. We're looking at a potential deficit of $9 billion and change. That's real money, of course, but how does it compare to recent years?
Well, you know, it's better, and I think that is certainly a start. I mean, considering where we've been, the $9.2 billion projected deficit is actually, when you look at it, the smallest projected deficit in about 5 years in California. We have really been through much worse times, and people certainly know that. In fact, if you look back at the first budget for Jerry Brown when he took office last year, he was facing a shortfall of about $26 billion. So that is definite progress. And I think you heard that when Governor Brown rolled out the state budget plan here in Sacramento on Thursday. You did hear, I think, at least a little hint of optimism in his voice.
This is a state that's dynamic. It's creative, and it's prosperous. This year, we're adding about $90 billion in new revenue to the gross state product. But we got our challenges. We got our problems.
And John Myers, you know things have been bad when a $9 billion deficit passes for good news. And you know, there's an old expression, never let a good crisis go to waste. In other words, you know, try to use it to accomplish things that you couldn't get done under normal circumstances. To what extent is the governor doing that with this particular budget?
You know, there is some of that. I think you're right, Scott. There's some interesting ideas in here. Certainly the cuts and the revenues are going to get a lot of attention, and rightly so. But some interesting ideas in here when you pull through the document. First of all, the governor is looking to consolidate some state departments and agencies. Now, not by as much as his predecessor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, suggested, famously blowing up the boxes, which never actually happened. And it's unclear how much Brown's proposal would save. But, you know, this consolidation of these departments and agencies, a lot of them which seem pretty archaic, it's great politics. I think, again, it shows the public he is trying to do more with less. A more noteworthy one, though, I think, at least in terms of maybe real-world impact, The governor's budget proposes a real major loosening of state-mandated rules about how money is spent in local K through 12 schools. Now, these mandates are called categoricals, and you've heard conservative activists for years say they need to be erased. It's too much meddling by state government. And now you've got a Democrat, Jerry Brown, agreeing with them, which would mean, if it passes, for local school officials a lot more freedom about how they spend their money. Schools, I should point out, do get protected in the budget the way it is crafted, but, you know, Scott, as we know, only if voters approve this tax increase that the governor's pitching for November.
Exactly, and that is a big caveat. Both the sales and income tax increases in November will be on the budget, and I guess if that passes, John, the deficit will be much smaller, about half as big. But does that mean he's pretty much giving up on getting any kind of help from Republicans in the legislature and is going to go right to the voters, assuming he does get the signatures to put this on the ballot?
Yeah, I think we're done with the strategy he had in 2011. You know, the governor told me in a conversation a couple of weeks ago he is convinced that the tax idea is a non-starter with legislative Republicans. I think a lot of people up here would have told him that, but I think he had to find it out for himself and see if there was another way around it.
Did he seem genuinely surprised by that, by the way, that he couldn't win them over?
I think he seemed disappointed. I don't know that he was surprised as much as he thought that it was worth asking them again and really, really shining a light on that. But he, you know, he spent a lot of time on that. And so now he does go out to the voters. He's got to gather signatures. This is a tax measure, as we know, that would raise about $7 billion of taxes a year for 5 years. It's a temporary proposal. Income tax increase for the most wealthy, a sales tax increase on everyone. The budget only assumes about $4 billion of that in the first year, and that is, you know, decisively for schools, and it would ease pressure on the rest of the budget. So the governor's going to make the case, I think, that these are about these taxes are about schools.
Someone described it as an expensive ransom note.
that's an interesting point, because that does go to show whether the governor should, like, you know, should the governor not, or yes or no, tell the voters, look, this is what happens. You know, the gun to your head, the ransom note idea. I think that some of this is fair in the sense that schools are the largest part of the state budget. And if revenues go down, then school funding goes down. But clearly, it's going to be a pointed conversation with the voters about what happens.
And just, you know, what kind of a mood do you think voters are in? I mean, they have rejected these kind of tax increases a number of times in the past 7 years, 8 years.
The polling shows, if you believe the polling, that the voters are more willing to consider this now. But I think, you know, it's a tough one. And I think the governor is going to have to craft everything he does in 2012 with an eye toward how the voters are viewing it. Remember, this is going to be effectively an election about the budget. Those taxes are crucial. If the taxes fail, the governor's budget, as he laid it out this week, says that schools would lose almost $5 billion. That's the equivalent of 3 weeks of the school year. No one is saying you have to cut 3 weeks off, but that's how much money it is. More higher education cuts. And then some small things that people will say, you know, gosh, is that political? Like no lifeguards at state beaches, no fewer game wardens in California, cuts to CAL FIRE in the courts. These are, what the governor will say, the real impact of not having additional taxes.
And finally, John, this budget wasn't supposed to be announced until next week. It leaked out about 6 days early. Tell us how that happened, and how did insiders at the Capitol react to all that?
It was the strangest budget release I've ever seen. Every year we have this thing where the budget is kind of under lock and key, and the governor starts to, and his aides start to reveal it to different stakeholders, interest groups, who sometimes leak it to the press. In this particular case, someone in the administration accidentally uploaded the document to a public server on Thursday, and the governor, who had just that morning said, you'll have to wait till next week, then by Thursday afternoon was having a press conference where he said, let's roll the whole thing out. And I think that actually really helped him. He got out in front of the story. He presented the budget, and frankly, it gives him more time to start selling it to people. So it was unusual, but I got to tell you, it was a welcome thing for reporters, because now we see it and we can start figuring out what it means.
Never a dull moment. Sacramento Bureau Chief John Myers, as always, thanks, John.
You're welcome.
For people who suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, one of the biggest problems they face is sleep. They have insomnia, or they're plagued by nightmares. Well, now, as scientists learn more about sleep and PTSD, promising treatments are emerging. Amy Standen reports.
Sam Brace doesn't want to talk about what he saw when he was a soldier in Iraq 8 years ago. These days, he's an inpatient at a PTSD treatment center, and this trauma is something he's actively trying not to dwell on. But what he can't control are his dreams.
Quite a few. I just had one last week.
They're almost always the same.
When I was overseas, we had hit an IED, and when I have a nightmare, normally it's something related to that.
Everyone has nightmares sometimes, but in people with PTSD, it's different. Steve Woodward is a psychiatrist with the National Center for PTSD at the VA Medical Center in Menlo Park. He says healthy dreams seem kind of random.
They're wacky. They associate lots of things that are not normally associated.
PTSD dreams, they're the same real-life event played over and over again, like a broken record.
Replicative nightmares of traumatic events that repeat for years, sometimes 20 years.
So the question scientists had was why? Why can't people with PTSD sleep normally? But to understand PTSD sleep, you have to understand healthy sleep. And that is where Matt Walker comes in.
What I'll do is I've got maybe 6 or 7 of the images queued up.
Walker is a sleep researcher at the University of California, Berkeley. His particular interest is in rapid eye movement, or REM. It's the part of sleep where a lot of dreaming occurs. But here's something else about REM sleep. It turns out REM is the only time of day that the brain stops producing a kind of adrenaline called norepinephrine. And this struck Walker as a mystery.
Why would rapid eye movement sleep suppress this neurochemical? Is there any function to that?
What Walker found is that in healthy people, REM sleep is kind of like therapy. It's an adrenaline-free environment where the brain can process its memories while sort of stripping off their sharp emotional edges.
So that you come back the next day, and yes, you can better recollect it, but also it doesn't trigger that same visceral reaction that you had at the time of learning.
And this makes sense, he says, because emotions are useful. They show us what really matters to us.
But I don't think it's adaptive to hold on to that emotional blanket around those memories forever. They've done their job at the time of learning. They've told you they're important. And then it's time to hold on to the information of that memory, but let go of the emotion. The emotion's done its job.
Letting go of emotion is the job of normal REM sleep. So Walker's theory is that in people who have PTSD, REM sleep is broken. That chemical we heard about earlier, the adrenaline, it doesn't go away like it's supposed to. Their brain can't process tough memories, so it just cycles through them again and again. And this begs a question. What if you could change that? What if you could make the adrenaline go away? Which brings us to a VA psychiatrist and researcher named Murray Raskind and a drug called Prazosin.
Prazosin was introduced in 1973 by Pfizer Pharmaceuticals to treat high blood pressure.
Prazosin is cheap.
It costs anywhere from 5 to 15 cents.
And actually, it's not terribly effective as a blood pressure medication. But what Prazosin does do is make people less sensitive to adrenaline, that same brain chemical that Mark Walker says is supposed to disappear during REM sleep. Prazosin doesn't sedate people or help them fall asleep, and it can cause side effects like dizziness. But in some PTSD patients, Prazosin can change the way they dream.
The third veteran we treated, we can call him Charles.
Charles was a Vietnam vet.
He had this recurrent nightmare of being trapped by the Viet Cong forces in a landing zone and having his best friend killed in front of his eyes by a mortar round.
After a few weeks of Prazosin, Charles came in for a follow-up appointment.
And he said, I don't know, Doc. I'm not sure this stuff's working.
I'm still dreaming, Charles said, just about something else.
But now I'm in my fifth grade classroom, and there's a test. And if I don't pass this test, I'm not going to be promoted to the next grade. And I never even got the assignment.
The stress dream, in other words, says Raskind, of a healthy brain trying to work things out.
And I said, Charles, that's my nightmare.
What Raskind and others found is that when people stop having recurrent nightmares, they start doing better in the daytime, too. And this seems to be the case in non-veteran PTSD as well, people recovering from rape and other kinds of traumas. This year, the VA will finish up its trial for Prazosin. It's already prescribing the drug to about 15% of its PTSD patients. Raskind, of course, would like to see that number rise.
To us, it's a simple thing that works.
Works, that is, at giving at least some people who have experienced something terrible a shot at a normal night's sleep. For the California Report, I'm Amy Standen.
More than 1,400 photographs were submitted by 245 people over the past few weeks, entries for our Only in California photo contest. Now, the photos came from every part of California, from the Salton Sea to Big Sur, the Sierra Nevada to the coast. Our panel narrowed it down to 6 finalists, and the public voted for their favorites on Flickr. The winner is Emiko Taki. She lives in Benicia, California, not far from Vallejo, and Emiko Taki joins us now. Emiko, congratulations.
Thank you, Scott.
Well, I want to ask you to describe your photograph for us. It's titled One Day from the Beach. Tell us about it. Describe it, if you would.
Okay, my husband, our dog, and I, we took a trip to Death Valley in Sierra Nevada over Thanksgiving weekend. And I just wanted to capture the California nature in my own way. Actually, we didn't know about this photo contest, and we heard it on our way to Death Valley. And my husband's like, oh, I think you should submit that. So, okay.
Good timing to be listening to the radio.
Right. So one thing I think California nature really describes or reflects California culture. And it's so diverse. It has ocean and the mountain, and desert, sunny beach, and foggy north beach, the wineries and farmland, and San Joaquin Valley. You know, it's so diverse.
And it's hard to capture in just one photo.
Right, yeah. And yet, to me, like when I look at 14,000 feet high Sierra Nevada mountains, it's so intimidating to me. It's beautiful, but it's so like sharp, and those sharp looking edges looks like almost like a teeth of a monster or something like that. And I think it's beautiful, but it's so scary and intimidating at the same time. And I think that's California.
So looking at this image, it is a person walking sort of in the middle distance. The person's very, very small, walking through the sand dunes toward the mountains. Tell us, who is the person and where are they going?
This was actually my husband. And to me, this photo really describes the whole trip, how I felt. And when I look at this photo, that's the exact feeling I get. The open, magnificent nature landscape, and it makes me feel so small. And that's the reason why I placed the person there too, because when you look at the landscape photograph, it's so beautiful, but it doesn't tell much story or emotion. But when you put a person there, it not only adds the scale, but it also adds another layer of emotion and story. And when you look at this photo, also, you can't see his face. He's so far away, you can't see he's actually turning this way or the other way. He's actually walking away from it. So it's up to you to interpret how you feel. So that's why I think it's very powerful.
Yeah, it's very dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Emiko Taki, thank you so much for entering the contest, and congratulations on winning.
Thank you so much.
And by the way, Emiko wins an iPad for being chosen. You can see her winning photograph and the other 1,400-plus photos submitted by our listeners. You'll find them at californiareport.org. Just look for the Only in California link. While the American season of giving wraps up with the end of the holidays, California's Sikh community continues providing social services to those in need. Sikhism was founded in India in the 15th century, and the religion emphasizes charity year-round. In late November, about 3,000 Sikh people gathered at a temple in Fremont to celebrate the birthday of their founding guru, Guru Nanak. Feasted, prayed, and continued the tradition of giving that the guru had preached more than 700 years ago. Women in brightly colored saris and bearded men with turbans greet friends and family. Many arrive at the temple called the Gurdwara with sacks of sugar, flour, or rice.
You will see wall to wall. All of this is all donated food. Sacks of rice. They're not small bags. They're up to 25-pound bags of sugar, up to 10 to 15 pounds of rice, to 25 to 50-pound sacks over here of flour. As they find out we're getting the donations, we get more.
For the past 7 years, Betty Saul has led the Fremont Temple's food drive. The Sikh community is one of the biggest and most reliable contributors to the Alameda County Food Bank. Saul also collects blankets that are donated to the needy.
People are very generous when it's time to give. They give what they do from their heart, what they can share, no matter it's a dollar, no matter it's $1,000 to $5,000, whatever they can do, they will donate what they can.
People form a line inside the sanctuary after taking off their shoes and kneel in front of a priest who sits, legs crossed, on an altar. They place money and food donations next to the altar, and the priest blesses them. After prayers, most people head to the langar, or the free kitchen, the mainstay of all Sikh gurdwaras. In the back of the kitchen, a man stirs a giant vat of chickpea stew. Several women sit rolling dough into balls, which will eventually be fried into chapatis or flatbreads. One volunteer named Sital comes every Sunday.
Our temple is never short of food. Anytime you come, there's always food. Anybody. Doesn't have to be a Sikh. It can be anybody in the world. That's what our God gave us.
Hardev Gruwa Singh sits outside the Gurdwara with a group of middle-aged and elderly men sipping chai tea. He's 76 and moved to California from England in 1969.
So we, at that time, there were very few families in this area. So people thought we need to have some kind of place for religious services. There wasn't any.
But with time, more and more Sikh people arrived in the San Francisco Bay Area. Many of them find work as engineers, nurses, and doctors. The region has one of the fastest-growing Sikh communities in the United States. Each Sunday, the temple also provides free medical assistance to people in the community. Amarjeet Johel, who recently moved here from Canada, got a free checkup.
Our religion says work hard, share, and be honest. That's our religion. We believe in it. We believe in humbleness.
Back inside the langar, people sit cross-legged on the floor, enjoying chickpea and lentil stews, freshly made chapatis and rice pudding. Young and old, rich and poor, share the same space and socialize with their fellow community members. Many of them will return next week, donations in hand, continuing the Guru Nanak's legacy. For some Christians, January 6th is the holiday for gift-giving. It's the celebration of the Epiphany, when the three kings showered the baby Jesus with gifts. In many Spanish-speaking homes, the delicate Christ-child figurine in the manger, or Niño Dios, is the centerpiece of the holiday. The ceramic dolls are often fragile heirlooms that end up breaking. KPCC's Adolfo Guzman Lopez paid a visit to a Southern California shop that acts as a kind of hospital for the little statuettes.
There's a sign inside Linwood's Plaza Mexico shopping center, just a few miles from downtown L.A. It says, Vestimos y reparamos niños Dios. We dress and repair Christ child figurines. Concepcion Cani Rivero, the doctor in this Baby Jesus hospital, surveys a table with a couple dozen figurines.
Here in this table, we have Baby Jesus from the size of 2 centimeters to 45. 45 is the biggest one. And they come for different reasons. Maybe they're missing a finger or the arm fell off or something. And then everybody bring them around this season and to fix them.
The damage is ghastly. severed hands and fingers, decapitations. One has a tear down the middle of its chest. Rivero uses plaster and water-based paint she mixes herself to repair them.
I try my best. Sometimes it's not exactly what the owner have in mind, but I kind of play with the colors and try not to touch the face of the baby too much, because I want the owner to be able to carry the baby and have the same sensation looking at the baby like before they bring the baby here to be fixed.
Rivero says it's not respectful to throw one away. The figurines are the most important part of Christmas nacimientos, or nativity scenes in Spanish-speaking homes. People reverentially place the Christ child figurine in the manger Christmas Eve, shower it with gifts on the Epiphany, January 6th, and put it and the other figurines away for the year with a party on February 2nd.
This tradition, the way it is now, is more from Mexico, and I'm from Cuba. And I learned that that tradition when I came here. I live in Mexico for few months on and off. And I learned about the tradition in different states, and I really, really like it.
Rivero has been so busy this season, she hasn't had time to fix her own baby Jesus after a friend's toddler broke it. She charges from $5 for minor touch-ups to $150 for major limb reattachments. Last year, 175 customers came through her shop. Most are from Mexico. Jose Jaime Velasquez lives just east of the shop and stopped by to check on the progress of his Niño Dios. He says the figurine was damaged on its way here from Puebla, Mexico. He wants to avoid putting it in the nativity scene that way, as he did last year. Connie Rivero spent so much time staring at the figurines during repairs that she can estimate their ages by looking at their hair and the shape of their faces.
Look at the eyes of this one here. Isn't that beautiful? This is glass, and I believe these eyelashes are made out of pelo de conejo.
Rabbit's hair?
Exactly. A lot of people like the baby Jesus with blue eyes. I like them like this. This honey color, I love it.
Rivero has been running this baby Jesus hospital for 12 years. She says it's equal parts business and a higher calling to heal the family treasures that come through her door. For the California Report, I'm Adolfo Guzman Lopez in Los Angeles.
And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director this week is Paul Ancour. Seal Muller is our technical producer, with additional engineering by Howard Gelman. The senior online editor is Gabriel Cohen, with help from David Marks. Our interns are Rigoberto Hernandez and Rebecca Wolfson. She produced our visit to the Sikh temple. Our producer is Victoria Malayon, with production help from Taiki Hendricks. Andrea Kissick was a contributing editor. Ingrid Becker is our senior producer. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. The California Endowment, building healthy communities because that's where health happens. More information at calendow.org. And the SunPower Corporation, offering high-efficiency solar energy solutions to households and businesses in California and worldwide. The world standard for solar. SunPowerSolar.com.